You know, he was up here blaming me for the air conditioning. Did you all hear that? Do you know what you have when you take me out of blame? Blah, blah, blah. Blah, blah, blah. I love it. My name is Mary Pearl. I'm an Al-Anon who's happy, joyous, and free. I love to play with alcoholics. God, aren't they fun? If you don't have one, go out and get one, for God's sake. It's always very special for me to be able to go anywhere and do anything with J.D. since he got sober. Although he's getting senile, you know, you have to hit it right there in the middle, you know, somehow. Thank you so much for your hospitality. All right, now to get down to what it's all about. You know, I'm supposed to share in a general way. I'm not doing a fifth step up here. What I used to be like, what happened, and hopefully I'm different today. Depends on the day. You never know. It's real good to be here and to see some old friends and to make new friends. I am a product of alcoholism. How about that? I have the family disease of alcoholism. When I was born, I qualified. I had a grandfather who died of wet brain from alcoholism. I had a grandmother who died of cirrhosis of the liver from alcoholism. I had an uncle that was shot in bed with another man's wife. He was drunk at the time, but my favorite. That was going to be some of my ism. And I had two aunts that died of the disease of alcoholism, so it was all around us, but we didn't go around them. They were that part of the family that you just didn't go around. But I love to watch it from afar. Have you ever noticed? You know, I'm an adrenaline junkie. If I have a drug of choice, it's adrenaline, you know. If I love excitement. If I don't have some, I create some. I mean, that's just the way my life is. And I would watch them, and let me tell you, it's exciting when you live around all those drunks. Because when they drank, they got mad at one another. And when they got mad, they did things to one another. One uncle wrapped a snake around the other one's steering wheel on his car. It had died, but he didn't know it, and he missed himself when he touched that snake. And I just thought, that is so funny! I love that! You know, I love their sense of humor. And the uncle who was killed, you know, he had a thing with guns anyway. One night we were all camping in the middle of the night. You hear the gun go off, kablooey, and a scream. And I think, my God, it's happening. What is it? And my uncle had thought what he saw was a snake at the foot of his bed, and he shot it, actually blew his toe off that he didn't recognize under the sheet. You know, he saw it wiggling. See, the other uncle had made him real spooky about the snakes, you know. Just fun times. But in our house, there was not any active alcoholism. Instead, we had untreated Al-Anonism. My mother was the only non-alcoholic in her family. I always felt like she needed a drink. She was the most neurotic, uptight woman you've ever been around in your whole life. And if it was fun, she didn't want to do it. She had a work ethic that if you're not working, you're not worth anything. So she was obsessed. She had to be out there working and doing and working and doing. And on the other hand, my daddy was, by the time I came along, I'm the youngest of four children. I'm a change of life baby. My brother was married when I was 5, my sister when I was 7. My other brother was dead before I was born. And so here I am, and my daddy, though, he's retired from a 35-year military career. And he wants to raise bird dogs, train them, and fish and hunt. And yes! I like that. I'm a tomboy. I want to do those things. So I spent my time with Daddy instead of Grouchy. You know, it wasn't too much of a choice there, you know. You have fun with Daddy, you know, not with her. And like I said, I love fishing. I learned lots of things from my Daddy. He would teach me. That was sort of a mixed bag there, because by the time I entered the first grade, I already could read, identify, spell, and define over 500 words. Now, if you've ever taught school, you know I'm going to be a problem child. Because I'm going to be bored, you know. And when I'm bored, remember, I create excitement. But there was this one day, Daddy and I was going fishing, and she decided to ruin our trip, so she came with us. She couldn't stand you having any fun either, you know. And so we got down there, and Mama has rules. Mama had rules for everything. And her rule about fishing was she gets to catch the first fish, the biggest fish, and the most fish. Other than that, you can fish. Well, I made a mistake, and I caught the first fish. It was just a little old fish about so long. But my mama looked at it, and she screamed, "That's not a keeper!" She ripped it off my hook and threw it back in. Well, I don't know about you. You know, I'm 5 years old. But even to this day, if it's got eyes and a tail, string it. And she hurt my feelings. And so I went into this screaming coma right there in the boat. And so Daddy said, "Honey, come back here at the back end of the boat with me." And as I got close to him, he said, "And we'll get her." I didn't know what it meant, but intuitively, I knew I was going to like it. And what it meant was every time she'd catch a fish, she'd swing around. Daddy would take it off, rebait her hook, she'd swing back around. And then he'd give me the fish, and I'd throw it over. Every fish the old heifer caught, I threw over that day. It gave me just warm, fuzzy feelings. And, you know, nowhere in that do I believe for 1 minute that my daddy realized what I learned that day. My daddy was playing a joke on Mama. But what I knew was, if anybody hurts you, you do it back to them as many times as you can. And you see, I found out that's where revenge came into my life. And I didn't know that till many years later when I'm doing a 4-step. And I had written that down as one of my most pleasant childhood memories. I love slow premeditated revenge, you know. I love it. Okay. When I was 12 years old, I was woken in the middle of the night, and my mama screamed, called for an ambulance, and I did, and I had the unfortunate thing to sit and watch my father die of a heart attack that night. And my world as I knew it ended, because my daddy, who I did everything with, who I worshipped, and who made everything right for me, was gone, and I was left with the witch. Later, I would call her the warden, you know. And it was like we declared war on each other. Whoever dies, the other one wins. I mean, that was the kind. Now, God help you if you had a kid like me. You know, if I had a kid like me, I'd kill it. I don't have patience for that mess. And she tried. She tried. There was a lot of physical and verbal abuse in the home because my mother, like I say, she didn't know how to deal with her feelings. And so when she would get angry, physical and verbal abuse were her forte. And I know today that even knowing I was going to get just beat to hell, I could not keep my mouth shut. I could not. I just could not do it, knowing what the consequences would be. That's the reason I'm saying you wouldn't want a kid like me. I was a rebel, and I was going to do. And if she told me I couldn't do it, I was honor-bound to do it because it must be fun and wonderful. Otherwise, she wouldn't tell me not to do it. She also admonished me, and she said, "You know, we carry the bad seed." She's talking about alcohol. She said, "Don't ever drink. Because we carry the bad seed, and everybody who drinks, look what happened in my family." And I thought, yeah, God, I can't wait. You know. Okay. In the late 50s, they put an Air Force base in at Little Rock. And there was an article in the paper that there was 10 men for every woman in town. And I thought, I want my 10. And I want your 10 and your 10, too. There's never too much of a good thing. If it feels good, do it till you die on the spot. So I went trolling. Now, this little Yankee boy never knew what hit him. But I should have known right off it wasn't going to work. He didn't like cornbread, turnip greens, or grits. It ain't going to work. But you know how we are. We got to do it anyway. But he said the magic words, "I'll take you away from home." And you see, I just knew everything would be all right. Once I got away from home. It's funny how we all live in the future, isn't it? When I get this, when I get away, when I do this, you know, happiness is always someplace out there. And I got a newsflash. If you ain't got it right here, right now, you may never have it. Because where's your guarantee you're going to be here tomorrow or out there doing this, doing that? Life is what you're going to make it, but I didn't know that then. So anyway, I married this little boy, and he did take me away from home. He took me further than I had ever asked to go. You know, they had things, great big boards on the sides of the road back then. And it says, join the Air Force and see the world. And it had like the Eiffel Tower and it had London. It had we went to Newfoundland. It was not on the billboard. What would they have put? A moose? I mean, what? You know, we had snow 9 months of the year. It was called semi-remote. God forbid you should ever go remote. And here we are in Newfoundland, and guess what? The worst thing about Newfoundland, it was boring. So, I mean, you know, I mean, I was looking out in my backyard one day, and I saw this moose come walking through, you know, and I go, oh, that's pretty exciting. But, you know, if you've seen one moose, you've seen them all. There's just not much going on, you know. Okay, what are those little lines on top of the ground out there in the backyard? Well, come the thaw, those are your clotheslines. You're hanging clothes up or you're stepping over them. You know, we had our annual snowfall was 190 inches of snow. Now, I'm from Arkansas. We don't have that kind of snow. If we get 4 inches of snow, everybody's going, close the world. Don't get out of your house. They have a forecast of snow and they close the schools, and that's the honest to God truth. So I didn't know how to deal with it. But after a while you do. And you just learn to adapt. And you're young enough where you can do that. But I still was bored. And I found excitement on the base. And where I found it was where I heard the sounds. The sounds of laughter. And the sounds of laughter were associated with the sound of ice going in a glass. And the sound of alcohol hitting that ice and going... You know how that little sound... Yeah, y'all know how that sound is, don't you? If you bother to use that. But anyway. But I remember the sounds of laughter, and my husband played the guitar, and he played in a band there on, at the club. And so while he would play, I would troll the room. I loved it! There were very few spouses and stuff that went up to that area, so there was always a bunch of men, and I loved the attention. Because, you see, I learned with Daddy, a man makes it all okay. A man makes it all okay. My husband wasn't making it all okay, but there was a lot of guys out there, you know. I worked for the Red Cross. I was assistant field director for the Red Cross for Newfoundland and Labrador. Now, this is a nice place to be because you get to meet everybody, and there's a little bit of power there, too. And I liked it, and I also liked playing games with the military, you know. I loved it. They had rules like you couldn't take booze off the base. They say you can't take booze on the Queen's Highway because it's not bonded liquor. Don't tell me what I can do and can't do in my own car. See, I just missed being an alcoholic this much, you know. It's called an allergy to alcohol. I had all the rest, you know. And I remember being pulled over one afternoon as I'm going off the base, and I had two grocery sacks full of booze. I was going to have a party that weekend, and they're doing check for alcohol at the front gate. And so the guy says, we're pulling you over for alcohol check. I said, that's okay. I got out, picked up my grocery sack, stood outside the car. He checked the car. I got back in. It's the military after all. They don't see what they don't want to see because, you know, they might need an emergency leave sometime. You know, here's your little bargaining power. I had a watermelon feast one time. I sent a KC-97 back to Little Rock, and they loaded up the whole bay with watermelons, and I was bootlegging watermelons at $10. I was enterprising. See, I had some of my mama in me there, you know. But I became very bored up there, and that kind of boredom will ruin your relationship. And so when we stayed there, they almost closed the base. They were in the process of doing that, and I came back home, and I knew everything was going to be different. Now, my marriage was in shambles. Make no mistake, my marriage was in shambles. But you know how we're going to try one more time? Why do we do that? You can't do anything different till you got something different to work with. And then, unfortunately, everywhere you go, there you are. But you don't know that. And so, anyway, we went back, and we were going to be at Little Rock Air Force Base. Well, the only problem was there wasn't an opening at Little Rock Air Force Base. And I was talking to my friend in psych assignment section. And I said, I said me. I didn't really consult him about it. I said, I want to go back to Little Rock Air Force Base because, see, I know it's going to be all better back there now. It's been a long time since I've been home, and I know things are going to be different. He says, there's not an opening in your husband's career field. I said, make one. I've always been a positive thinker. And he said, well, there's just not one. I can't. And I said, well, then change his career field. He said, oh, I can do that. With a stroke of a pen, my husband, who was an aircraft mechanic, was now the head of a missile inspection team. He'd never seen a missile. They put those in while we were gone. And, you know, guess what? It doesn't work back home one more time either. And so they got all this straightened out, and they sent him on to another base, and I told him I wasn't going. I said, you know what I really need is to find myself. I was lost. I said, it was called fast talking for slow thinking, and the bottom line was he came from a broken home, and he would have done anything rather than to have a broken home. And so, therefore, I played on that. So I convinced him I wanted to be separated but not divorced. I wasn't ready to be self-supporting through my own voluntary contributions, people. You know, I may be sick, but I'm not stupid. So he agreed to that. So he went on to his next base, and then I was there, and I was free for the first time in my life. I don't have her telling me what to do. I don't have him in there. I don't know what to do. Now, when you're a rebel and you rebel against everything, if there's somebody not putting out what you're supposed to do, you don't know what to do. So you watch. There was interesting things going on in my neighborhood. There was this boy and girl lived across the street from me, and he'd go out and get drunk, come home and beat her up. My family, that was my mom's family, you know, I knew all about that. And so this little girl, she wasn't English speaking, and since I had lived in Canada, I could speak French Canadian. So anyway, we became friends, and she was pregnant. He went out one night, got drunk, came home, beat her up, and she went into labor. And she came over to my house, and she said, would you take me to the hospital? And I was looking at her. There she is. Her eyes are turning black, and her lip is busted, and it's swelling up. And I'm looking at her, and then we went over to her house to pack to take her to the hospital, and he's passed out with a smirk on his face, laying on their bed. And I looked at him, and I thought, this ought not to be. This is not right. And there I said, you know, somebody ought to do something about that. And I had a spiritual awakening. I am somebody. So I tied him up in his bed sheet. I took a slat out of the bed, and I beat the fool out of him. And it just made me feel good all over, you know. Took her on to the hospital. Next morning he comes over, and he says, do you know where my wife is? He says, I've been looking for her. And I said, she's in the hospital. She had a baby last night. He said, well, I was in a hell of a fight last night. I bet you were. There's one lived on the other side of me. Did you ever feel like you were a carrier? Wherever you go, there they are, you know. And this guy lived on the other side of me, and the doctor told him that he was an alcoholic, and if he were to continue to drink, he would die. He quit drinking. Died anyway. Never found Alcoholics Anonymous, but he would say, that's when you learn about irritable, restless, and discontent next door. It's funny how we're always looking out, looking out. Now, I'm free, so I'm a night person by nature, and so I would get home around 7 o'clock in the morning from having fun, and he had a garden in his backyard, and he had the audacity to want to till his garden in the early hours of the morning before the heat got up. And I went out there and explained to him that I was in here trying to sleep, and he told me to shut my mouth and get my butt back in the house. He didn't know about Mother and the Fish. So, 11:30 at night, I decided to mow my lawn. Well, the sheriff came to see me. Have you ever noticed law enforcement people are narrow-minded? So I go into Plan B. Every good pre-Al-Anon has contingency plans. So I go into Plan B. Now, Plan B was Freeman. That's the guy's name. He had this backyard, and he had a dog pen back there, and he had six beagles. Now, if you got one beagle, they're barking little dogs. But you got six, you got a chorus out there. So I'd wait till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. I'd run off my porch, run across the yard, take a broom handle, run up and down that dog yard fence, stir those dogs into a frenzy, then I'd run Jack back on my porch and wait. And he'd come staggering out the back door in his underwear, screaming and cussing at them dogs, sometimes hose them down. And then he'd go back in the house, and we'd wait about an hour and do it one more time. And the sheriff came to see me. Well, there were several other little plans, C, D, and whatever, but it occurred to me one day the sheriff and I had begun to develop a relationship. So I might ought to cool it, and I looked elsewhere for entertainment, and that's when I realized we have a neighborhood softball team. I'm an athlete. I love softball. So I would get me some stretch boots, some hot pants, and I joined the team. The queen is here. So it was a mixed team and all ages, and we were just out there having a good time, just one little neighborhood and another, and playing back and forth. And it was our custom after the game to go back over to somebody's house, and we'd pop a few tops or whatever. And some of them would sniff some stuff, and there was others smoking these little funny cigarettes, and some had these sugar... normal neighborhood in the 60s. Just your normal little neighborhood, you know, and I'm finding myself, you know. And so it was time for them to be over at my house one night after the game, and we're doing that, and all of a sudden this one kid I noticed over there, he was only 18, which is not legal age, to drink, and he was drunk. And it was, and you know, it was at my house, and I thought, God, if he gets picked up going home by the sheriff, now I'm going to have contributing to a delinquency of a minor on me. So to cover myself, I decide I'll drive him home in his pickup, and somebody will follow us and bring me back. And we got in his pickup, and there was a China tea set sitting on the front seat of his truck. And I said, what's that? He said, that's my mom's Mother's Day gift. And I thought, my God, he can't carry that in the house. He'll break it. He's so drunk. So, you know, ever helpful. So get the picture. It's the wee hours of the morning, and I'm walking into a house I've never been into before, escorting a drunken 18-year-old kid, and I'm carrying a China tea set. Your everyday situation. And we got stumbled through the house, and we got over to his room, and he flipped the light on, and there's a man laying on the bed with nothing but his underwear, and he goes, oh, hot damn, little brother, you brought us a broad home. That was J.D. I said, not tonight, fella. And I went on. Later on that summer, we met again, and I had a three-day birthday party, and I like to party hardy. We started seeing one another, and, you know, it was just, it was really, really neat, because J.D. and I could sit, and we could talk with one another, and we can do all of these things, and we did that, and we had a wonderful relationship for about 4 years. Now, what happened? Was he not drinking during those 4 years? Well, of course he was drinking, but he was going through a period of controlled drinking, you know. I had never seen anything like that because everybody I knew just drank or didn't, you know. I knew that he didn't know how to drink right, and I tried to teach him. Having a date with J.D. drinking was like being with several men at the same night. It's like having your own little harem out there. There was the quiet guy who hadn't had anything to drink, didn't care much for him. And he arrived, and we went out, and after he'd have a couple of drinks, then now he's ready to party, and now that's wonderful, but I just didn't have him very long. Because he kept on drinking, and as he kept on drinking, his personality began to go downhill. And then after a while, he began to think of every sad thing that ever happened to him. Now, God, that is misery to be with. And then I'd have to tell him about that, and then he would get a mouth on him like a Chevy trunk. You could not shut it up for nothing, and that's when I had to just put him out of my misery. Now, violence entered our home, you know. But then J.D., he ruined all this fun we were having. He asked me to marry him. You see, there's a time to mention things. And if you go past the right time to mention something, the right time just doesn't seem to present itself again. You know, and I said, well, I can't marry you. And he said, well, why not? Don't you love me? I said, it has absolutely nothing to do with it. And he said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, I'm married. He said, you're what? And I said, I'm married. He said, you're married. I said, I forgot. You know, out of sight, out of mind. I'm having a good time. They call it in the program, hearing what you want to hear, seeing what you want to see. Now, see, I had this before the alcoholism ever came whipping by. Already had all of these symptoms in place. And so I filed for a divorce, and we got married, and alcoholism moved into my house. Now, that was a real shocker for me. because I really didn't pay that much attention to it until after we got married. There's something that happens when a woman gets that piece of paper that says, you belong to me. That's what it said. This man belongs to you to do with as you see fit for the rest of his life, if it should last that long. You know, that's how I perceive that, you know. And see, this time it's going to work. I'm not going to do the things that I did in that first relationship. But those things in that first relationship was going to also come back to bite me in the kind of things that was going to happen to me in this relationship. And I had said, I'll never put up with these things from a man again. And I didn't. I put up with different things that were worse than the first things. But they were different. This was how I kept doing it. The things that would happen, and the violence would increase. Because, you see, I had a total inability to deal with my feelings. A total inability. And the more fearful I became, the more angry I became. And the more angry I became, and if you don't deal with anger, it'll deal with you. And it began to spill over. And so there was a lot of violence. In the beginning, there was a point where I drank with him, and then that just wasn't getting it anymore. And then there became the period that I went and I stalked him, and I would try to bring him home. And then it was really irritating to me to go into a place that I normally wouldn't be caught dead in, find him with a lower companion, find it necessary to turn the table upside down, slap her flat, throw a drink in his face, and the bouncer would throw me out. And I'm the only one sober. But we all know I wasn't sober. I wasn't emotionally sober. I was drunk with emotion and could not deal. And if you can't deal with your feelings, they will deal with you. Time went on, and finally I told J.D. that he was going to have to leave, that I couldn't put up. And this is many times I've thrown him out and this kind of thing, but I'm talking about meaning it. And I told him, he said, well, I don't mean to do what I do. I think there's something wrong with me. And I thought, boy, that's the truth. You are 666. So I took him to our local doctor, our family doctor, and he told the doctor he thought he might have a slight drinking problem. That's like the Titanic saying we had a slight hole in the ship. Anyway, the doctor told him that all he knew to tell him to do was go to Alcoholics Anonymous because they seemed to have more luck with people's drinking problems. But J.D. wasn't an alcoholic. And he turned to me and I said, he's not an alcoholic. You see, he didn't drink like my grandparents. He didn't drink like my aunt and uncle. It was different, don't you see? Everybody gets an idea of what they think an alcoholic is, and J.D. wasn't it. And he said, but he had some friends who were taking a drug, and if he could get some of that, he knew he'd be okay. All he needed was a little help. And the doctor said, what's that? And J.D. says, they call it an abuse. And the doctor said, yes. Now, I know the doctor didn't say what I heard. I heard the doctor say that I could give him a pill every day, and he couldn't drink. Now, that's what I swore the doctor said. That was not what the doctor said, but that's what I wanted to hear. So I became the keeper of the pills. By this time, I have high blood pressure. I have an epileptic dog, and J.D.'s on the pill. Every morning in a hurry going to work, I can't guarantee who got what, but everybody got a pill. Now, for years, I have said, if he'll quit drinking, my life will be okay. Well, he quit drinking. My life was not okay. Now, that's hard to take. So what is the problem? It wasn't his drinking. It's him. I wasn't ready to look at me. It was him. And so we could not, I don't know about you, but if you've ever lived through a year of dry drunk with no treatment for alcoholism and no treatment for the family disease of alcoholism, it's a miserable way to live. Just little things like, what do you want for supper? Anything. Would you like fried chicken? No, I don't want fried chicken. Well, what do you want? Anything. Well, you want some spaghetti? No, you make the world's worst spaghetti. Thank you so much. Well, what do you want? Anything. So I would fix anything, and then he would look at it and say, you don't expect me to eat this, do you? And I'd say, well, you have a choice. You can eat it or you can wear it. Sometimes he ate it, sometimes he wore it. And it was there in that part of the sickness that I really began to go downhill. And it was when the committee moved in. I mean, I was just sitting there thinking, and see, that's when I hear somebody I sponsor say that, that terrifies me. Because our thinking is so messed up. And my thinking will lie to me, and it will tell me things are okay that are not okay. And what I was thinking was, I need away from him. He is the problem. And my thinking says, well, why don't you get a divorce? Well, you can't get a divorce. Well, what do you mean I can't get a divorce? Well, you can't get a divorce because you've already divorced one. If you have to keep divorcing them, guess what's going to be the common denominator? We are not going there. Okay. Well, what are we going to do? Well, if he were to die, you could be a widow. What was that? Well, if he were to die, you could be a widow. It wouldn't be like being a divorcee again, but he's not dying. We can take care of that. Oh, what do you want to do? Well, let's take an ice pick, stab him in the neck, and watch him drip. Oh, it was wonderful. Or better yet, why don't we back over him with the car and squish him up in the tread? Make a note, buy new tires. You got to have the deepest tread possible. I begin to feel better. There's light at the end of the tunnel. Now, see, that's crazy. Now, do you see the importance of having a sponsor? If I'd have had somebody that I could have run this past, surely they would have noticed something was a little amiss here. But I was taking care of me. And so you'll always co-sign your own bull. Never, you know. So anything you feel like you can't tell somebody else is the one thing you really need to tell somebody else. And so I went on, and I noticed in the paper a woman had killed her husband and said he was an alcoholic, and they put her in prison. And I said, that would never have happened if I'd have been on that jury. Tacky, tacky. So now I've got to have another committee meeting. And so I'm thinking that fall, I'm sitting there and I'm thinking back and forth, and all of a sudden, you know, well, if an alcoholic were to pass out in the bathtub and drown, who would know? We all liked it. It was a group conscience. Now you've got your plan in place. It doesn't matter exactly when, but you see there's light at the end of the tunnel. And sure enough, a year to the week, J.D. went on an interview study, came home drunk. And we had ice and snow in Arkansas. And I heard the car coming down the street. You know how you get used to hearing the sound of your car, especially if you're waiting. You know your car from 16 blocks away. And I hear it, and it's like he's doing 40 or 50 in second gear. You know, that kind of a sound. And he came in, and he missed the driveway. He hit the hitching post horse, which was cast iron in concrete. Flip, knocked it off. He went sideways across the yard, hit the tree, and then bounced into the side of the house. And I'm standing there at the front looking at that, and I think, he really can't drive on this. Well, I lived in Newfoundland. I can drive on ice and snow. He can't, you know. But then he opened the truck door, and he poured out. I'd seen that too many times, and I said, I'll kill that SOB if it's the last thing I ever do. So when he came through the front door, normally, you know, we had this little conversation. My mouth was attached to the door when he would open it. And it was different this time. It was different. When he came through the front door, I never said a word. I just hit him as hard as I could. And he always says, you don't hit like a woman. Well, I was raised on that highway, and there was 11 boys and one other girl. So you learn to be a guy, you know. I mean, you hit with a fist. You don't do that nail scratching and stuff. That's not it. So I knocked him over, and when he fell, he hit the coffee table, and it knocked him out. And so I drug him across the living room floor, down the hall, into the bathroom. I turned the water on. Filled the bathtub, took his clothes off, put him in, and held him under until the bubbles quit coming. And he was laying there in the bottom of the tub. And there was a voice that was not a committee member that said, look what you're doing. You can't do this. And I picked him up by the hair of the head, and I looked at him, and I said, the hell I can't. And I put him back again. Now, perhaps if you're talking to voices back and forth, you might think something's wrong. But the voice came back again, and it says, don't you see, you're committing murder, premeditated murder, and worse than that, you're taking the life of someone you once loved. And it's like the big book describes it, a moment of clarity. When you see yourself as you truly become, and I have become an animal to fight an illness. It like to have scared me to death. If you were told me I was capable of premeditated murder, I would tell you you're nuts. But there it was. It was right in my face. And I jerked him out of that bathtub. And thank God I had worked for the Red Cross, because I knew how to resuscitate him. You see, God always goes ahead and plans in love and gives you everything you're going to need. And I took him in that bedroom, and I dried him off, and I put him up in the bed. I even got the hair dry down and dried his hair because I didn't want him to catch cold. Dead, but no cold. You have to take care of him with a cold. Don't want that. And I shut the door on that room, and I went in there, and I rocked for the next 8 to 10 hours with a desperation I had never known in my life. You see, I didn't know how to live any differently, but I knew I couldn't live any differently. There was nowhere to go. So my best friends jumped in to save me. That was justification and rationalization. And they told me, if he hadn't have got drunk, you wouldn't have had to do that. It's not your fault. It's his fault. So that's how you can justify attempted murder. It's not a big deal. No big deal. And he was in that room for over 3 days, and I heard him scream and beg for help. And I heard him holler and ask me to come in and do something. And I wouldn't go in because I still vacillated between wanting to murder him and not. And I was afraid of what I would do if I went in that room. What I didn't know was J.D. had alcoholic poisoning. He nearly died in that room. He nearly hemorrhaged to death in that room. You see, you think you know about alcoholism, but you don't. You know about all of the sickness, but you don't know about alcoholism. It's different. Alcohol wasn't his problem. Alcoholism was his problem. I had gone on to work and tried to function. Keep going and doing, just keep going and doing. And I came home one day, and he was sitting at our bar, and he was shaking so bad. He said, would you call that number, that Alcoholics Anonymous number for me? I've been trying all day, and I keep getting the wrong number. And so I called, and there was a real sweet lady there. She's long gone and with Bill and Bob. And her name was Mary Peeler, and she told me, she said, honey, there's a meeting 1 hour's time away, 6 blocks from your home. And it was a community building that was built by my grandfather, who died of wet brain from alcoholism. And that's where AA was meeting, and lives were being saved in that very building. And so I took him over to his first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. There was 2 ladies that came over to me, and they said, we have Al-Anon, it's for you. And I said, there's nothing wrong with me. Nothing wrong with me. And so anyway, when he left that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, thank God it was old-time AA, because nobody said, you know, when you get around to it, get a sponsor or do this. There was an old man went over to him, and he said, boy, I'm going to be your sponsor. And Durwood helped save J.D.'s life. He was with him. I thought he was living with us there for a while. He was an old bachelor. He drove me nuts, and he would say such hateful things to me, like, if you don't get off his ass, he ain't going to have a chance. You know, stuff like that. I didn't want to hear that. But one night, he and the old guy didn't come back from the meeting, and I knew they was both out drunk. And every time Jay did go to the meeting, the Al-Anons, there was 2 in the group, they would send him with some pamphlets home to me. And I wouldn't read that trash. But for whatever reason, God knows, I didn't throw it away. I put it in the desk, and there came the night when they didn't come back, and I was scared. I figured him and the old guy both were drunk. I began to look, and there was a little business card that said, my name's Earlene. If you ever need to talk, give me a call. It's 11:30 at night. I need to talk, Earlene. And so I called that woman, and I talked to her and told her that I was afraid they was both drunk. She said, no, they're probably just talking, and that really scared me. Because I thought, what if he tells what goes on in our house? And it wasn't about his behavior, it was about my behavior that I was concerned. Because I had this big, high-power job, and I did not want it out that I was a husband beater. I just did not want that out. I wanted to do it, but I didn't want to have... You know, isn't that like a little kid? I won't do it just till I need glasses. You know, that kind of thing. I don't want to have to take consequences for anything up here, you know. And she said, we have Al-Anon. And I said, well, I don't think I need it. And she said, okay. Well, the very next week, J.D. got fired from a job that he worked maybe 1 or 2 days a week for 10 years. 1 or 2 days a week. They said, when he's here, he works better than anybody we've got. But all of a sudden, sober, he couldn't work. He was still shaking so hard he could not work. And so that was what got me to go to Al-Anon. It was my own self-centeredness. You see, all of a sudden, my things were being threatened. And now it was all on me to support us. And so it became more of a burden than I could bear, and I went to Al-Anon. I'd like to tell you, I jumped right in and said, yes, this is it. It took me a long time, and it took me about a year. And you know, it's real funny. I went every day to a meeting, either of Al-Anon or Alcoholics Anonymous, because the alcoholics were so kind to me. They would answer my questions, and they showed me nothing but unconditional love. You don't always see that in our fellowships anymore, and that's a real sad thing, because we got so sick together. Let us get well together instead of this separation bull that's going on all the time. But anyway, I would go to these meetings, and I began finally to get a grasp. I got a sponsor, and guess what happened? When you start to work the steps, then you begin to get better. It's amazing, you know, how long you want to be sick. You know, you can be sick here as long as you want to be. You know, try to do it by yourself. Don't work the steps, that kind of thing. But it took me a while before I could identify. I would hear the alcoholics talking about resentments, and I'm thinking, you're such weenies. Little pipply resentments. A resentment is when you take me to work, and then you go and sit in a bar with another woman all day. Now, I can tell you about resentment. That kind of thing. And I had all that anger and all that rage, and it took a long time before I could identify that it all came back to self-centered fear. And I had to study the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, because you see, I am a Big Book Al-Anon. And I find myself on the pages of that Big Book. I don't have an allergy to alcohol, but everything else lines up with my life. Everything else. I relate to the whole schmear, you know. And I have a lot of friends in AA that'll tell me I'm just a six-pack short of getting there. But whatever, that just, I firmly believe that if alcohol doesn't do anything for you, it don't do anything to you. And alcohol never made me feel blonde and 6'2" and a willowy and stuff like that. It just never did that for me. Alcoholics did that for me. As I began to get better, one of the things, too, that I noticed, that relationship. You know, J.D. and I, we're going to talk about relationship tomorrow, so I'm not going to go too much on that. We found that we could live together in the same house and not necessarily hate one another all the time. It took time. I had to take my focus off of him and everything and work on me. And then after, there comes a point in time when you've got to work on the we. You're together because you think that being together is better than being by yourself. You know, that kind of a deal. So I began to do that. But the main relationship that was worse than the one with the alcoholic was with my mother. That was the nemesis. All my life was my mother. My mother was getting old, and I thought, oh, my God, she's going to die. And every time I'd go over to try and make an amends to her, we'd get into another fight. We couldn't be together 5 minutes and talk with one another until we were at it. If I said it was black, she said it was white. If I said it was up, she said it was down. We just could not be together in the same room any period of time without that little conflict taking place. And I would walk away with my feelings hurt. And when I'd get my feelings hurt, it would make me mad, and then I would have to turn around and tell her. So my sponsor gave me an assignment that I couldn't tell her anymore. That is so hard on your teeth. The inside of your jaws, you know, where you plunk. And I found that when I need to tell her is when I need to leave. And so I would leave. And when my mother would call on the phone to talk to me, I didn't want to hear what she had to say, so I would do this. Mm-hmm. Oh. Okay. I wasn't listening to anything she said. She just talked nonstop. And I just didn't give her the gift of time. The gift of time or the gift of listening. I didn't know how to listen with an open mind, not trying to judge what she was saying was right or wrong, just listening. I didn't know how to do that. And I was told that if I wanted to repair this relationship, I was going to have to do some things. First of all, I always went over there wanting my mother to be different than she was. And guess what? It has to start here. Anything you want, you got to be willing to do. And so I was told, quit expecting your mother to be what she's not. Accept her just as she is. give up the dream of how you thought that relationship was going to be. And let me tell you, dreams die hard. Because I wanted her to be that cookie-baking kind of mama that would be there with that smile on her face and tell me I did good. My mother never approved of anything I did, and I was the class valedictorian, the straight-A-plus student. My mother never went to any class function, any support, none whatsoever. She was working. She was working. And I resented that. I resented that. And that hurt me deep within. And they said, sooner or later, you're going to have to give up all hope of having a better childhood. It's over! You can't change the past. But if you live in the past, you're screwing up right now and any hope for the future. You're going to have to. So I was going home from the meeting squalling my guts out that night. And as I crossed the bridge from North La Rock, or from Little Rock into North La Rock, I said, God, be my mama. You've been my daddy for a long time. Be my mama. Be for me. Or put in front of me the what I need, because I know my mama doesn't have it. But I need it. I need it. And God began to show me I had been getting it from other people, and I had just not honored what I had been getting because I wanted her to do it for me. I wanted her to be my mom. And when I took the pressure off of her to be something she wasn't, then she could have the freedom to be what she was instead of fighting me all the time. And then they told me to act like a kind and loving daughter. How does one do that? They said, find people who have a good relationship and ask them what they do and then do that. And so, you know, it was always an agony for me to send her a Mother's Day card, a Valentine, anything, because they're all so sweet, you know. And I just couldn't bring myself to do that. I wanted one that said, Happy Mother's Day, bitch. Well, we have computers. We could do that now. But I didn't have a computer then. See, God knew. God knew. And so I finally started buying those sicky, sweet cards and sending them because that's what she wanted to get. See, I'd get those little shoebox cards by Maxine that say, the longer you bitch, the longer God lets you live. That did not thrill my mother. And so I began to do that. You know, I'm real grateful I did that because after my mother died and I was going through her stuff, she had saved every one of those cards because, you see, she desperately wanted to be the kind of mother that I wanted her to be. And those cards gave her a little confirmation that maybe she wasn't a bad mother. I think there's not a woman alive that doesn't wonder at some point, have I done something wrong? Did I do something wrong? The truth is, there's no perfect parents and there's no perfect kids either. You know, we're all just out there trying. Well, I kept on and then I was given the gift. And the gift was, ask God to let you see your mama like he sees her. You see, when God looks at either one of us, he doesn't have grandchildren. We're all his kids. And God looks at his creation through eyes of love. Because God is love. God can't look at you other than through eyes of love because God is love. And that makes a whole difference. And I'd ask God over and over, please let me see Mama like you see her. And one day, the gift came. I had gone over to my mother's in the fall of year, drove in the driveway, and all of a sudden I noticed Mama was way out in the backfield and she was raking. She had this thing about her whole yard had to look like a park, and it did. It was gorgeous because she loved to martyr. See what I do, you know, I mean, but it looked gorgeous. And I'm looking at her and I realized something. My mother's short. Now, what kind of an idiot are you that you don't know your mother is short? I never realized she was real short. She came up to about here on me. I'm thinking, why would I not know that? And then it was just as clear, because every time you come as a child. And when you're a child, Mama's big. And when you come, you always came asking Mama to give you something. Approval, love, whatever. What did you ever bring? You see, a child is selfish. And I had come always asking and had never thought about bringing something to the relationship. You know, it's like life is a big potluck. What are you bringing? What are you bringing? And so I was bringing resentments and anger and hurt feelings and all those things. and asking her to fix them. You see, I'm real glad my mother didn't approve of a lot of things, because had my mother approved of them, I would have shortchanged myself. I would have thought approval was love. And there's a big difference, because I can love somebody and not approve of some of the things that they're doing. I would have shortchanged myself. And so I realized as I'm walking back there that God let me see inside my mother's heart, and it was full of scars and hurt. It was not a heart full of love. And you see, I always felt like Mama withheld love to punish me. And if anybody had learned to love, where did I learn about love? In rooms like these with people like you. I had been given the gift. And if anybody was going to bring love into that relationship, it had to be the person who had it. And I said, it's not fair, you know. But it's the way it worked. And so I continually, every time I'd go to see my mom, that day I gave my mom the first hug. And my mom was stiff as a poker, because you see, she didn't know how to receive love anymore, and she knew how to give love. But I was consistent, and when I'd go around her, I'd give her that hug or the pat. You know, there's great power in the human touch. And I would treat her, as the book says, like a newcomer. And those were things I wouldn't hesitate to do with a newcomer. And over a period of time, I realized my mama had done the very best she could with what she had. And one day I went over there to visit my mom, and my mom said she wanted to know how come it was when Daddy died I became such a rotten kid. I said, I was getting even with you for not loving me. And she said, what do you mean I didn't love you? I said, Mama, you never told me you loved me. You never held me. You never hugged me. You never approved of anything I ever did. I had no way to know that you loved me. And she said, I gave you a roof over your head. I gave you food to eat and clothes to wear. It was more than I ever had. You see, my mother had been raised with all that alcoholism. And it was a brutal family that she came from, and she was the oldest girl. And she had been beaten. Mama had scars on her body where Grandpa had come in drunk and cut her up with a knife. And her mother was drunk, and there was no one there to protect her or defend her. And when my mother was around 13 years of age, my grandpa came in. He exposed himself to her many times, but he came in and tried to kill her and rape her. And she was terrified, and she picked up a stick of stove wood, and she hit him in the head and ran away from home. You know, it wasn't fashionable to be a runaway in the early 1900s. And my daddy was the head of the recruiting office for the Army in Memphis. And my mother walked all the way from Gleason, Tennessee to Memphis. She stole food out of people's gardens. And she lived under the little culverts at night and stuff before she got there. And she was living in an alleyway next to a boarding house. And the woman that owned the boarding house was a Jewish lady, and she was pregnant. And she told my mother she would give her room and board if she would help her in the boarding house. And my father took his meals in that boarding house. And that was how they met. And when she turned 16, they got married in the parlor of that boarding house. Now, if you'd had to live like that, what would be the greatest gifts you could ever give a child? Never to worry about a roof over your head. Never to worry about food to eat. Never worrying about something to clothe yourself. You see, my mother gave the very best she had, and I had thrown it back in her face for years, expecting that, not realizing that can be a luxury. And you know something? That day, it became enough. And I looked at my mom and I said, Mom, what could I do to make it up to you for all the hurt that I have done to you all of these years? So many things on purpose. What can I do to make it up to you? She said, forgive me for not being the kind of mother you needed. And I looked at her and I said, Mom, I think you were, but if you need that, I forgive you. I forgive you. And my mother got up. She walked across the bedroom. She put her arms around me and held me, and she said, baby, I love you. I've always loved you. And that healed. That healed that hole inside of me between me and my mom. And I'm real grateful, because about 3 or 4 years later, my mom got a mental illness, and part of that illness is they turn on the people they love. And, of course, J.D. and I were it. It wasn't too long after that that she had a series of strokes that put her in the nursing home. And this is when I realized that my sister Dorothy, who's 16 years older than me, had been that mother that I wanted all my life, because Dorothy had always been loving, supportive, kind, approving. She had done everything I wanted mother to do, and I couldn't see it because it didn't come from where I was looking. But I had it, and I was able to honor her and thank her for being the mother all my life. In November the 30th of 1999, 45 years to the day I watched my daddy die, I watched my sister die in the front seat of my car. We were in bumper-bumper traffic. I finally got the attention of a motorcycle cop, and I'm praying, God, what do I do? Do I do CPR? I'm driving a car. What do I do? What do I do? And the cop led us, and there was a hospital 7 blocks away that had been open 2 weeks. And we took her there, and they were able to revive her, but she was blue when I got her there. She was in a coma for almost a month. And Dorothy, as we know her, will never be again. She had been down 10 to 12 minutes, and they call it anoxic brain injury. She lost oxygen to her brain too long. And so my sister has no short-term memory, and she lost about 25 years. And so it has been a real difficult thing since then for the last 5 years. And back in December this year, up to that point, I had, after we had taught her how to walk and talk and do all those kind of things, she was able to stay in her home, and I provided a caregiver to be with her around the clock, because Dorothy's diabetic, and you never know if she's going to think to take a shot, not think to take a shot, take 2 shots, that kind of thing, when you can't remember. It became financially impossible to do that. You can be surprised. You can go through $500,000 in 5 years with care, that kind of care in your home. And so in December, this past December the 27th, I had to put Dorothy in a nursing home and sell her home and all of her belongings, all of her treasures for all of her life. She'd lived in that home for over 50 years, and that was probably one of the most painful things I have ever had to do. And she was doing pretty good up until yesterday. And after I got here yesterday, I found out that she was being violent in the home, so they may have to put her out. So I don't know what the future holds, but I know that God does. And God has walked with me every step of the way, and I don't see any reason why He wouldn't continue to do that. But I would ask for your prayers as we continue in our journey. But I want to tell you something. I learned to deal with Dorothy a lot, and I think if I had been there, we could have prevented some of this, but that may be her deal, trying to keep me there, too. We got to watch her. She's manipulative. When she gets real angry, you know, she'll swing and like, I'm going to do something, and I get her by the shoulders, and I say, And then she'll laugh, and then she's forgot what she was mad about. And she says to me, though, she says, promise me, if when we're out driving again, if I die in the car with you, you won't have me revived. And I said, Dorothy, honey, I promise you, if you die in the car with me again, I'll drive around 6 or 8 hours till you're stiff as a damn poker. That may be true, too, you know. All I know is that I love my sister, and I know she's in there somewhere. She's in there somewhere. But the main thing is I know God, and I love my God, and my God is always there. He's not somewhere. He's right where I need Him when I need Him. And that's the thing I want you to remember always, that God goes ahead of you, and He plans in love. So whatever comes your way, that 24 hours. You know, Dorothy's taught me how to live in the minute. She watches CNN all day long. It's new to her every 30 minutes. Make you rip your hair out, I'm telling you. But she's told me that you can live in the minute. But, you know, it's sad when at Christmas time, I said, Dorothy, what would you like? And she said, I'd like my memories back. And, oh, God, if I could. But then my first and only graveside amends to this point was with her husband. I didn't like him at all. I didn't want her to marry him when I was 7 years old. And so she asked me here a while back, she said, who was I married to and what was he like? And I said, you really don't care, Dorothy. He wasn't memorable. She said, okay. I didn't like him because he was abusive to her. He was verbally abusive to her. And when he would get mad, he would not talk to her for days on end. And that just broke her spirit. And, see, I wasn't in the program, and so I had to get even for her. So I did it. I owe him a graveside event. I made his life a living hell. my life goes on. And you know, JD, we just found out back in December that JD has a health issue now that we have to deal with. So there's always something, because you know, just because you're in the program doesn't mean you're bulletproof. Life is going to continue to happen to you. But by the grace of God and people like you to be there, we never have to do it alone. And for that, I am truly grateful. My life is but a weaving between my God and me. I do not choose the colors, but He worketh steadily. Oft times in sorrow, sometimes foolish pride, I forget He sees the top while I the underside. Not till the loom is silent and the shuttle cease to fly will God unroll the canvas and explain the reasons why. But the dark threads are as needful in a skillful weaver's hand as the threads of gold and silver in the pattern God has planned. Thank you for having me.